Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, a busy week for financial journalists everywhere. Wages are up, inflation is, well, kind of the same. What does it mean for mortgage rates, the state pension, benefits, and the economy generally? Well, one thing we know won't be affected by the latest figure is income tax bans. Just how much is the big freeze, a fiscal drag, going to cost us? Also today, Royal Mail not delivering post, how to get a good estate agent to sell your home, and we take a look at the new Tesla Model 3, weigh up the cheap entry-level e-Citroën, and ask, would you drive to France with an EV? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, at the start of the year, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak set the target to halve inflation by the end of 2023. So that's just over 5%. And it was looking promising. But we have the latest inflation figures, and they might have thrown a bit of a spanner into the work. September's CPI reading came out at 6.7%, exactly the same as August. So a few questions arise from this. Many, but we don't have that long. What will the Bank of England do next? And thus, where will mortgage rates head? We now know the third lock of the triple lock, but will it stay? Will benefits also rise in line with September's inflation figures? And will Rishi reach at least one of his five targets? Firstly, inflation figures came the day after we got wage growth data. Lee Boyce, Simon Lambert, welcome to you both. Lee, just dig into the details of those a little bit more. Cheese, I understand, is falling.
Cheese. That's like, out of everything you picked, Georgie, you've gone cheese.
Yep.
I love it.
I went with the important stuff, firstly.
That's the stuff people
excellent,
want.
Excellent news for Liz Truss.
Exactly.
Yeah, so we had the CPI reading this week, 6.7%, same as the month before. That comes off the back of a number of months of CPI easing somewhat. Remember when last October it was peaked at 11.1%, it had been kind of gradually coming down a couple of months where the pressure was off a little bit of the Prime Minister when it was coming to the inflation target. And, you know, it was looking like maybe that 5% target could be reached. But I think that this reading makes this difficult now. The September reading is going to make this quite a difficult thing. And we've been talking about this a little bit, haven't we, about the rising fuel prices was the real big one here. So petrol prices have been rising. We've now added to the mix. We've got the conflict of what's going on in Israel, you know, which might have a knock-on effect to oil prices and, again, what we might be paying at the pump. But that's for next month's reading. One little nugget of news, talking about cheese, you know, food inflation has been falling somewhat. So that's one little...
Still pretty high though, Lee, isn't it?
It's still high. Mm. Yeah, there's no doubt about that. But the real rise of the CPI was the fuel prices. So up 3.6% month to month in September. Education CPI rose 1.8%, driven by a 6% hike in private school and nursery fees, which was well above the 3.7 last year. It is getting expensive to send your children to private school. I mean, it's expensive anyway, but it's getting more expensive. And nursery fees, I mean, the pressure that nurseries are facing, you know, I hear it all the time. And prices are going up accordingly. So all of these things are making it difficult for this inflation figure to fall any further. I think when you look at the US, and they've managed to sort of get more of a curb on inflation. I think it's almost half of what we got here at the moment. Mm-hmm. And they've obviously done all of the interest rate rises, but now there's murmurs of more rate rises from the Fed. And then we've got more decisions to come before the end of the year about base rate. Does this influence the thought process behind another potential base rate hike next time round? Well, it's definitely more food for thought. I think if the inflation figure had come down somewhat, maybe it would be more nailed on that there was going to be a kind of freeze. But I think this sort of fuels the flames somewhat in that regard.
It does indeed. I mean, Lee, you said about whether it's got further to fall. I imagine next month we'll see the energy price figures feed into those. So we might get a dip down. But Simon, the figures that the Bank of England are looking at closely. The core inflation, I think services as well are two, if you dig into those details. What are they telling us and what do you think? Because it seems to me, taking a look at the markets, still think there might be a hold next time. When is it? November the 2nd?
Yeah, I don't think inflation sticking at 6.7% is a particularly major issue. There were expectations that it might come in at 6.6, but there were also expectations in other corners that it was going to come in higher because the price of petrol and diesel has gone up substantially in recent months, and that is, you know, going to feed into the figures. I think the Bank of England knows that. I don't think the Bank of England is particularly concerned by that. And in fact, actually, if you look at something like petrol prices, for example, that does some of the Bank of England's job for it, because ultimately people can make two decisions. They can either drive less or they can just pay more for the petrol and have to spend less elsewhere. And there comes a point where a lot of people can only make the first decision up to a certain level, and then they have to just accept that the petrol is going to be more expensive. And most people just suck up the more expensive price of petrol. It doesn't make a huge amount of difference to the amount that people drive, unless it spikes way, way, way higher. And that means that they have a bit less money elsewhere. So what you're seeing is that that then feeds through into slowing down the economy, which is obviously the point of raising interest rates, which is why we look at core inflation. Core inflation excludes volatile fuel, energy prices and food, and also takes out alcohol and tobacco, which are basically tax. You know, that's what you're paying. Core inflation, 6.1% in the year to September. That was down from 6.2% in August. So it's heading in the right direction. Recent high was 7.1% in May. That was what sparked the freak out over the summer that sent mortgage rates spiraling and interest rate expectations spiraling. We've come out the other side of that freak out now. Core inflation's heading in the right direction. Inflation's heading in the right direction. Whether Rishi's going to halve it by the end of the year is a matter that's very much up for debate. He's not got that long left. But I suppose he can always point to petrol prices and say, it's not my fault, Gov. But what I think is important for the Bank of England is the decision of whether they go one more now, you know, next time round, maybe one more this year, basically, ultimately, or whether they hold for the rest of this year, because I think it's going to be easier for them to go one more, maybe, you know, November, December, than it is if they hold until the start of next year to then go one more next year. And expectations are erring towards the side that we're done. Nobody's quite willing to come out and say, cast iron, we're done. They aren't going up any further. But then you had the Fed and, you know, Jerome Powell talking yesterday, and everybody's thinking the same thing about the US. And then he's saying, well, we might not be done here. And that's sent markets on another wobble. And we've seen bond yields spiking in recent weeks. We've seen them spike and come down a bit and then spike again. And all of these things fit together. And it shows the sort of uncertainty that's there. But even if there is one more here or in the US, or even if there's two more, I think we're very much near the top of the cycle this time round. It's the what happens next after that that's the big question.
Yeah, don't worry, I won't ask you that quite yet. Where I want to go now is mortgage rates. If the Bank of England are going to hold or even raise it slightly, we still, Lee Boyce, aren't we seeing mortgage rates edge down? I mean, I'm checking the Money Facts daily press releases. It's down like teeny tiny points. Sometimes it holds every day. What do you think? Where's it going?
I think the mortgage market has definitely settled. Simon was talking about that May spike again and sort of the freak out, and mortgage rates started to kind of go higher again. In the last sort of 2-3 weeks, we have seen some major lenders bringing out some, you know, relatively competitive deals. And it's been a slow, it's not like all of a sudden mortgage rates going to come flying down. There's definitely more competition. Lenders are definitely in the market for trying to get more people to go with them. And as a result, we are seeing mortgage rates slightly ease. but I think they're probably just about settled at where they're going to be.
Wow, because I was reading someone saying 4.5% by the end of the year. Is that a wee bit optimistic then?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if that's optimistic, but I mean, the difference between, you know, it all depends, doesn't it? I mean, it's a hard one to call, the mortgage market. Yeah. I think we've come off the back of this year, absolute kind of madness in the mortgage market. I mean, we have seen rates spiral, people struggling to remortgage at rates that aren't completely what feels to them astronomical. I think that 4.5%, I mean, there's not much more of the year to go. And yeah, we have seen some major lenders come out with some sub 5% deals. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, with a mortgage, it just depends on your circumstances, doesn't it? And how much your LTV you need and you know, what kind of length you're looking at. There's so many variables in it. So it depends on your circumstances. My hunch is at the moment they have kind of got to a level point where, yeah, we might see some rates falling and we might see the overall rate coming down somewhat. I think that maybe more of those kind of moves might happen in the new year, when perhaps lenders are feeling more kind of aligned to what is going to happen next. You know, what is going to happen next to interest rates? You know, if we reach the peak of the interest rate cycle, will we start seeing movements down? I mean, that's what I think the next big thing is. And I just feel like we're coming now towards the end of October, and I can't imagine that there's going to be massive, you know, widespread cuts. But there might be potentially, you know, the good thing is about mortgages that quite often you can take your mortgage out or, you know, have it that offer, and then you can change it later on down the line. So it's not like you'll take this mortgage out and it's this rate right now. And then if a rate comes down 1%, you know, the likelihood is you could probably still take advantage of it. So there's not the other thing, the flip side to this, and another signal that kind of we might be at the kind of peak, is savings rates, and the fact now that fixed rate savings are really starting to come down somewhat, especially the 1 year fix, which has been the kind of barometer of where the best deals have been. You know, we're in this unusual circumstance where fixing for 1 year has paid you more interest than 2, 3, 5 years, which is really quite an unusual thing. But we are starting to see those rates dropping off, which might be a signal that maybe mortgage rates have got a little bit further to soften this year. But it's a hard one to call. All you can say is you can deal with the facts of the last couple of weeks, and that is lenders like Nationwide and HSBC have been cutting rates, and that can only be a good thing. You know, they're such major players that the smaller competitors really have to make cuts as well to sort of keep up.
I guess the key thing is that what I'm looking at when I see these press releases is the average figure. And actually, like you said, it depends on your circumstances, but this is probably where a broker really can help and find the best deal, or even just shopping around and finding the best deal, because that is an average. And of course, you could get probably a better deal than that. So, you know, if you are coming to the end of a deal.
I think with the averages thing, I think, you know, it makes sense to look at it more for an averages of how much you need to borrow, in terms of, you know, are you someone that has been a homeowner for a while and you need a, you know, 60% LTV? If you're someone that's got a 10% deposit and about to buy a home, you're 90% LTV. And the difference between the rates are quite substantial. So I think that average rate is a fine kind of barometer of what's going on. But I think it depends on what you're actually looking for. It could be quite vastly different to that figure. And I think that's, you know, the big cuts have come for those people that are looking for a 60% LTV, essentially, because lenders see them as the safest bet. You know, they've got equity in their homes and they've got, you know, they've got most of the deposit there. So that's my own personal hunch. I keep an eye on the MoneyFax averages for 2 year and 5 year fix, but I also take it a little bit with a pinch of salt because of the different sort of circumstances people are in.
Simon, I want to go back to the kind of general economic picture. Your article on the inflation figures included a little bit about stagflation and whether we'll have it, and whether recession is on the cards. These are big economic terms with big consequences to the pounds in our pocket. Likely?
Maybe. Before I go into that, though, if you do want to know how much a mortgage is going to cost you, this is money.co.uk/mortgage-finder. Type that in. You will find our mortgage finder. calculator. You can put in the value of your home, you can put in your mortgage, you can put in how long you've got left, you can choose how long you want to fix for, and it will tell you the kind of rates that you could personally apply for. Doesn't mean you're guaranteed to get them, but those are the kind of rates you could be applying for. But back to the bigger picture, recession, two consecutive quarters of negative growth, i.e. the economy shrinking in two consecutive quarters. Are we going to get there? Maybe not. Might not happen. Might still happen. Nobody really knows. Does it really make a difference whether we have a technical recession or not? Not hugely, because you can have an economy that's struggling and have people that are struggling without having a recession. It could be that there's just a chunk of people who are really, really struggling. There's certainly a chunk of people who are getting hit by these mortgage rises and another chunk of people who aren't being affected by them. There are a chunk of people who are, you know, finding their wages falling behind inflation, struggling with the cost of living. And there's another chunk of people who are having to give up a holiday a year. And that's not that tough. But the recession thing obviously matters from that bigger picture, looking at the economy. Every time we think it might happen, all of a sudden we manage to get a little bit of growth in there. And actually, you know what, to be honest, I think the economy is doing better than most people think and most people expected it would do. Britain's consumer economy is it's the cockroach. It really is sometimes. You just can't keep it down. But I don't know, you know. Then you look at the stagflation thing, and that's possibly something that's more likely to happen, which is when you get economic stagnation combined with inflation. So the price of stuff's going up, but the economy isn't growing. And that could be that you get stuck in a low growth world at the same time as you get stuck in a higher inflation world. And we were in a low growth world post financial crisis, but we were also in a low inflation world. The problem comes when you have low growth and high inflation, because ultimately you need growth in order for the economy as a whole to get better and improve. And then that feeds down to people and people get a bit richer. And if you people want to be paid more money, then you need increases in productivity and increases in growth so that businesses and organizations can afford to pay people more money. The government can get more money in so it doesn't have to keep taxing you more whilst it keeps spending more, which is something we'll talk about in a minute. So stagflation is a real risk. It harks back to the 70s. The 70s was the golden era of stagflation. It wasn't a golden era in that sense, but it gets talked about quite a bit. Don't know whether it will happen. I don't have a crystal ball, and I'm an optimist, so I work on the basis that actually something's going to come along, there's going to be a catalyst, and everything's going to get much better.
That's the spirit, Simon. That's the spirit. We are going to talk a bit more about the inflation figure, for the fact that this particular inflation for September's is a key one. It can dictate where the state pension and benefits head. And once upon a time, income tax, had the tax bands not been frozen, then taxpayers would have been taking home an extra 6.7% from next April. All right, for 1 year, we can let that slide. But they will not budge until 2028. Hello, fiscal drag, the stealthiest of all tax raids. Lee Boyce, fiscal drag, frozen tax bands. Explain.
This is one of those things I think that's fallen a little bit under the radar in terms of people really wising up and knowing what's going on with their take-home pay. So fiscal drag is essentially, it occurs when thresholds and allowances don't keep up with inflation or wage growth, and more of us basically become liable for more tax. That is it in a nutshell. And this is what has been going on in terms of our take-home pay. So back in 2021, Rishi Sunak froze the income tax allowances and the personal allowance. And then when Chancellor Jeremy Hunt came in 2022, last year, he extended that freeze for an extra 2 years. So that has taken us all the way up to 27-28 tax year. Now, as you say, usually these bans and allowances would be rising with inflation, and this marks a important month because this would be the figure which would be used. Now, if a personal allowance is currently at £12,570, which it was at 2021-2022, by 2024-2025, so which would be the financial year that starts from next April, That would be at a high of £15,225 if it had gone with inflation. And I think the number of people that are getting scooped into the higher rate tax bracket is a pretty big talking point at the moment. So the threshold is £50,270, again, where it was at 21-22. If it had gone up with inflation, these are figures by AJ Bell, by the way, by 2024, 2025, it would be at £60,886. That's where the higher rate tax bracket would be sitting right now. And actually, what it means is more and more people are getting dragged into the net. Essentially, millions more people are getting dragged into that higher rate tax, 40%. And I think that if people really kind of looked at this and thought about this, I think there would be quite a lot more anger about this. So,
but that's why the government does it. It's the stealth tax of all stealth taxes.
Yeah, because if you stood up at a red box, you know, a budget, yeah, instead of, you know, raising income tax by a penny, exactly, or whatever it is, it doesn't look good. But according to the IFS, so the IFS did some research into this week. The number of people paying higher rate income, so who are on the higher rate tax bracket, was 3 million in 2010. It will be 9 million by 2027, according to their research. And put another way, that is one in six adults will essentially be higher rate taxpayers. Wow. That's a big old figure. And it's going to raise tens of billions of pounds more for the Treasury over the time. And I think that it's you get your way. It's one of those things, isn't it? Let's say that you have had wage growth this year. Let's say your employer's been kind and given you a pay boost. It almost feels at the moment for a lot of people that boost is just getting wiped away by the fact that, you know, they may be getting dragged into this higher rate threshold, or, you know, just feeling it in their pay packet anyway. And it's a very sneaky thing that's going on. And I just, it's one of those things, what gives? You know, we've got an Autumn statement coming next month, middle of next month. You know, will anything change? Well, I wouldn't have thought it, but it's going to be more of a talking point, I'm going to suggest, between now and then.
No, Simon, you don't agree? I don't.
No. Look.
No, what?
Okay, so I said this week, I opened my column with the line, there comes a point at which a stealth tax stops being stealthy. And by my reckoning, we reached that last autumn when Jeremy Hunt faced the backlash on this that his predecessors dodged. People have wised up to this. It might not be that everybody's wised up to it, or they've wised up to the full extent of it, but people have wised up. And I think this is, well, I think it's a major problem actually for people's earnings. This is a major, major problem for the Tories. And this is not a political podcast, right? Okay, we don't really talk politics on this, but I mean, I'll tell a story and explain why I think this is a problem. Way back when David Cameron decided to call the Brexit referendum and say that we were going to get a vote on whether we were going to be in or out of the EU, up until that point, it was a fairly niche interest. It was pretty fringe. So out of all my friends and family, so I'll take friends and family, not people that I work with in journalism, but friends and family, I only can think of one person who was really kind of agitating for a referendum on, you know, we really need a referendum on the EU. Lots of people would grumble about the EU, right? They complain about it, you know, this and that, Europe this and Europe that. The people weren't that interested in getting out. David Cameron calls his referendum. All of a sudden, it's headline news. Everyone's interested in this topic. But when he called it, pretty much everyone's general line of thinking was, yeah, I mean, he's called it. It's fine. We're staying in. I mean, that's the reason he thought he was going to get away with it, didn't he? He didn't want us out. He thought he was going to get away with it. And then it turned out that when this stuff hit the headlines, there was maybe a bit more of a sort of feeling of let's get out now than had been cottoned onto. And over the months after that, I sort of realized from reading the comments on our articles that there was this groundswell of opinion that actually, yeah, let's get out. And we had a poll, which we talked about at the time. And there was a huge number of people saying we would be better off outside of the EU than in. And this alerted me to the fact that maybe it might not be the clear-cut win for Remain that people were thinking. And, I mean, you had the whole mechanism of Project Fear going on. The government was pro-staying in. The Bank of England was pro-staying in. All of the kind of authority figures were pro-staying in. And they were doing quite a heavy-duty job of trying to convince people to stay in. Now, obviously, our readership is slightly skewed. But this is money readership I'm talking about here, okay? So they're not, like, hugely skewed on it. But there was so much commenting going on. I thought, well, hang on a minute. This is definitely an issue. I didn't call it. I'm not claiming any kind of Mystic Meg thing here. But I remember saying at the time before the vote, I don't think it's actually going to be the clear win that everyone's thinking for Remain. Now, when I'm reading articles that we're publishing at the moment on tax, my column yesterday that was published has 465 comments on it. And I read the comments. I do read the comments on my columns, not just the ones calling me an idiot. I read the other ones too. I would say about 90% of those people are complaining about the Tories and taxes, okay? And saying, what's the point? What's the point in voting Tory? What's the point in voting for the Conservatives? They've just whacked up our taxes. This is just a Labour government in disguise. We might as well vote for Labour. There's no reason not to vote for Labour now. They've been sticking up our taxes for years. It's just a load of grumbling about their taxes being stuck up. And again, you know, this is money readership. You know, it's reasonably balanced, but it probably skews towards voting Conservative. It skews towards, you know, business, money, entrepreneurialism, all those kind of things. And people don't vote Labour because they're worried that they're going to do something bonkers and they're going to put up their taxes. That stops the kind of swing voter in the middle from voting Labour. I don't think that the Conservatives are going to win the election on that basis anymore, because I think that they've sort of gone round in circles chasing their tails on so many things in recent years that they might be falling down on the first one. And on the second one, people have clocked this. They've worked out how much of their money is being grabbed by taxes, by stealth taxes, by freezing thresholds, by all of the other tax traps in the tax code, because this doesn't just affect your income. This affects the savings tax on your interest. So everybody has £1,000 personal savings allowance. But if you're a high rate taxpayer, you only get £500. So all those people dragged into the high rate tax plan, that's it. Boom, down to £500. If you're an additional rate taxpayer, you get no personal savings allowance whatsoever. Now, you had to earn £150,000 before you're an additional taxpayer until Jeremy Hunt reversed Kwasi Kwarteng's removal of it and dragged that down to £125,000, £140,000, which is a weirdly precise number. Why is that a weirdly precise number? Because when people earn more than £100,000, they start getting their personal allowance taken off them at a rate of £1 for every £2 they earn, which gives an effective marginal tax rate of 60% to those people. Very difficult to elicit sympathy for people earning more than £100,000. But there is no way that you should have a tax system that goes 20% tax, 40% tax, 60% tax, 45% tax. That's just completely bonkers. Also, ever since that £100,000 thing was brought in, that limit hasn't changed either. In fact, actually, if that had risen with inflation, it should be about £150,000. If the 45p tax band had gone up with inflation, it should be much higher. If the 40% tax band had risen with inflation, it should be over £60,000 by now. If you have children and your earnings go above £50,000, up between £50,000 and £60,000, you get child benefit taken away from you. That, again, creates a marginal tax rate of more than 50% if you've got one child. If you've got two children, it creates a marginal tax rate of 59%. That £50,000 hasn't changed. It stayed the same ever since it was brought in. And what makes it worse is now more people are being dragged into higher rate tax. So they're not just facing the child benefit charge, they're also getting taxed 40% rather than the 20% they would have been charged if the tax threshold had gone up. Then you've got tax on dividends. Again, you pay more as a higher rate taxpayer. You've got tax capital gains tax. You pay more as a higher rate taxpayer. And the allowances for those have been cut, and they're going to be absolutely slashed to the bone from next April. Mm. And people have totally wised up to this. And they're looking at this, and you get comments like, might as well have voted for Jeremy Corbyn. That does not bode well. Okay, so I think it would be really great if Jeremy Hunt sorted this stuff out in the autumn statement. I think he should sort out all the terrible bits of the tax code, like the child benefit bit, the removal of the personal allowance, all the other little traps that catch people. I think he should raise the personal allowance up higher than £15,000, help those people, the lowest earning people. I think he should raise the higher rate allowance. I think he should sort out, you know, some of the other messes. But I just don't think that even if he does that, it's really going to make that much difference. I think, unfortunately, he will be shutting the stable door long after the horse has bolted. And, you know, judging by the tone of the comments at the bottom of our articles on anything to do with tax, I think they've got a real problem.
Yes, for not a political podcast, I'm afraid we do have to touch on these things. And when, if Labour come in, we will also be touching on the way that they deal with things. But Lee, I do have to ask you one final point on this. The latest inflation figure means that we have the three locks of the triple lock in place, 2.5% wages, which were 8.5%, and inflation, which is 6.7%. And given the triple lock mechanism, it is whichever is higher of the three. You don't have to understand a lot about maths nor about triple lock measures and strategies to know that 8.5 is higher than 6.7. So in that case, pensioners are going to get another big boost, are they?
That's fantastic maths, Georgie. Well done. I loved it. It was really good. Yeah, so from April, the big question is now, will they stick with the triple lock at 8.5%? There's been some murmurings and some rumours that they might use a lower sort of 7.8% rate, which strips out the bonus element of this wage growth that they're saying is skewing the figure. And then, as you say, you've got a CPI rate of 6.7%. We did a poll on a story that Tanya Jeffries did, our pensions and investments editor. More than 3,000 people voted on this poll. How much should the state pension rise by next April? Fairly simple question. 88% said 8.5% rise. 6% said 7.8%. 5% said the CPI rate of 6.7. And 1% said other. So I think that gives you, again, we talk about the polls on our website being slightly skewed, but it still gives a flavour of what people were thinking. And it could be all out war again if they scrap that 8.5, even putting it at 7.8%, even though the Treasury, you know, the government could say, well, you know, we've saved some money by doing this. It will still not leave a good taste in the mouth of state people that claim state pension. They will grumble about it, there's no doubt about it. So you're kind of damned if you do, you're damned if you don't type scenario. I'd be very surprised if it doesn't get stuck at 8.5%. I can understand the removal of the bonus part of the wage growth. I mean, it kind of makes sense, and then when you look at it on paper, it's a 0.7 percentage point difference, but people will get annoyed by that. It's the optics, isn't it, Lee?
Say, oh, look, to be fair, but it's like the second time out of 3 years you'd be fiddling with the mechanism.
Well, the figures are as follows, right? So with an 8.5% rise, if you've got a flat rate pension, you're talking about £11,502 a year, and a basic rate pension, 169.50 per week, which is 8,814 a year. If you do the 7.8 rise, it's £11,427 a year. So a difference of about 50, 60 quid. No, sorry, no, it's about 70, 80 quid. Sorry, my maths there. And then the basic rate is 8,756 quid a year. So the differences aren't huge. So it's, yeah, I wouldn't want to be making this decision, Georgie. And with the general election coming up next year, I mean, I can't see much else other than 8.5%.
You could explain all you want to the nation's pensioners. This is a fairer way of doing it. The numbers have been skewed by these one-off bonuses, you know, to help improve the NHS, which is obviously a benefit for all, slightly more of a benefit for the older people, in fact. And actually, that when you break it down, it's only £6 a month. But, you know, if we're all in this together, and saving this money makes a real difference to the economy, and people will still be absolutely furious if they do not stick with the triple lock. The way promises work is you have to stick to them. If you make a promise, you have to stick to it. And if you break the promise, then, and you explain why you've had to break the promise, and it is an exceptional circumstance, you have to make sure you then stick to the promise afterwards. And unfortunately, the government tried to play its get out of jail card free 2 years ago when the wages numbers were skewed by the post-COVID recovery. And it can't play that card again. It's got to use the 8.5% figure. And if it knew there was going to be a problem with the figure, it should have dealt with that before now. It should have dealt with it. It should have looked at those figures at this January this year and gone, well, there's a problem with these figures because they include the bonuses, and bonuses can really skew things. And why are we really including bonuses? Most people don't get bonuses. So actually we should be using this other figure. And they should have gone in January, right, we're going to change this number. There would have been an argument in January. It would have bedded in and everything like that. By the time it rolled around to now, you know, there would have been a bit of fuss and grumbling and everything like that. You can't just change it now. That's going to count as breaking the promise. And I don't think they can do that. Like, you've got to stick to your promises. I do think that all of the political parties need to come up with a better system beyond the next election, though. And I argued this the other week. I think we should come up with an aim. If the aim is that the state pension rises by, in real terms, so we want pensioners to get richer, genuinely richer, rather than just keeping pace with the cost of living, then we should have a double lock, and it should be either inflation plus 1%, or it should be 3%, which is the inflation target, plus 1%. Get rid of the wages one altogether.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam North of eToro for our weekly look at what's been going on the markets. Sam, how has the past week been? A little bit rocky, perhaps, I think.
Yeah, stocks have been feeling the pressure due to growing geopolitical tensions and rising bond yields. Elsewhere, we've seen China's quarter three GDP, which actually exceeded expectations. US retail sales continued to surge, a little bit of positive news. In company news, Tesla and ASML reported earnings and they missed, while Netflix beat expectations. Nvidia is also facing challenges from new Chinese chip regulations, albeit they don't think that's going to matter too much. Additionally, Lululemon is now part of the S&P 500. As mentioned before, bond yields are on the rise. US 10-year at 5% or near it, with the German bond yield at 3% too. Stock valuations are holding up a little bit better this time, so a bit of a positive. But yeah, commodities market, Brent around $90 a barrel due to those concerns in the Middle East. US natural gas prices, however, did drop 10%. Due to increased production, inventories and mild weather. Yeah, a busy, rocky week.
It hasn't been helped by comments from the Federal Reserve, which has given the stock market a knock today, and the FTSE 100, which had been sort of doing okay, has taken a bit of a knock this week as well, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, there'd been a while, hadn't there, where the FTSE had been recovering a bit after an awful start to the year. So yeah, these comments haven't helped too much. The markets have come under pressure, and it's now, you know, going into a period where we're expecting seasonality to improve, this isn't going to help it too much. But yeah, big week ahead. I'll obviously keep a close eye on what happens in the Middle East, where rising tensions could impact global oil markets. Big earnings as well. Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Meta, all reporting. You've got Visa, Exxon and Coca-Cola too. And then on Tuesday, we get a glimpse of the global economic landscape with the flash October PMI data. Thursday, ECB rate decision and the highly anticipated US quarter three GDP figures as well. Also, for those that are looking at elections, Argentina and Switzerland have those at the back end of the week.
So just a quiet week for half term then.
Yeah, just a quiet one.
Okay, Sam, thank you very much. We'll catch up next week.
Thanks, Simon.
Welcome back. You had just one job, Royal Mail, one job. But it seems that households are only receiving their post once a week. Hospital appointment letters, birthday cards, parcels, and important bills have all gone missing because of delays caused by a staffing crisis. In Brighton, households say they're receiving mail as infrequently as just once a fortnight. So Lee, are there some legal obligations? Is Ofcom doing anything about it? What's going on?
So first of all, we should say that this is a situation that's affecting certain postcodes around the country. So for some people, they are probably still receiving their post daily. I speak as someone of experience of this. Our postman is here every day. You know, while it's very hard, one of those jobs in which, you know, without the post, he's delivering all this stuff, you know, what would be getting done? You know, that's my viewpoint. Now, what's happened and what we're hearing on the ground, so we did this story There are certain areas and pockets of the country in which post is just simply not coming. You know, once a week, once a fortnight, as you just pointed out there in Brighton, that is simply not good enough. And it's simply not good enough when the cost of a first class stamp has gone up 14% recently from £1.10 to £1.25. People expect those letters to be delivered for those kind of prices. Now, since we've had this story, we've had lots of people write in with similar problems, saying that, for example, they didn't receive post. They hadn't received post for sort of a week, 2 weeks, and they went to the local sorting office and they had all of their letters and parcels there. They had to go and collect it themselves. We don't want to be in that scenario where we have to go and collect our own post every time we get it. And we've had lots of people writing that are actually posties and sort of telling us kind of what's going on. So we've got a follow-up coming on this story. But it's kind of worrying for people, especially if you rely on things, as you say, hospital appointments. You know, we're still in a situation in a kind of world in which all of this stuff is automated and sent out by post, and there's not really another option, and that's the way these things are done. And if you're not getting that until after your appointment, well, that's not really good enough, is it? And we actually had Caroline Lucas commenting this story, who's the Green MP for Brighton, and said that lots of her constituents have been in touch, experiencing problems with deliveries, and they're missing hospital appointments. It can compound grief and heartache in certain ways. So what I mean by that is that a mother who received lots of adults that were lots of letters that meant for her adult son, but they came after he'd passed away. I mean, that's the kind of thing that's just, you know, horrible, isn't it? And that's the kind of reliance that we do have on the post. Yes, perhaps we don't send as many letters and cards as we once did, but we're only going to send fewer letters and fewer cards if the service is really this trash. And off, you're right. So talking about Ofcom, they're investigating delivery failures, and it does have the power to fine the Royal Mail if it uncovers, you know, kind of what's going wrong.
Is that going to help, Lee? I mean, is it going to help if they've got staffing issues and problems? Is drawing more money away from the company going to actually help them improve? Are there alternatives? Can we get someone else to do it? Feels like this is going on for ages.
It's one of those things. They're under pressure from parcel delivery companies that, you know, we've all got much more kind of reliant on getting things sent to our home in terms of packages and parcels. And that's one part of the business that, you know, the Royal Mail has been trying to improve. But then is that at the detriment of its core business, which is, you know, the letters and cards that people send? I don't know. I think having Ofcom breathing down your neck at least shows that, you know, someone's watching you. You know, there is a regulator watching you and saying, wow, you know, people are paying for this service and they expect certain standards. And if those standards aren't being met, why aren't they being met? And why is it that certain parts of the country that appear to be struggling, why are they struggling? Where are these staffing issues coming from? Why is it being so difficult to, you know, employ people for what is a brand, a name that is known across the country? You know, why is it so hard? I mean, to have the Royal part of Royal Mail in there, I think people expect a certain standard. And at the moment, I'm not saying this is everywhere. As I say, I have no grumblings about our local post whatsoever. But for some people, this has become a real problem. And the real kind of anger and upset in some of the letters, well, I say letters we've received, but I mean, this is from email. Otherwise, we might not have gotten.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it really shows the problem and still the reliance people do have on post. So if you are someone that is sort of listening to this and going, oh, yeah, really, we really aren't receiving letters and things on time, get in touch with us, editor at thisismoney.co.uk. We're compiling all of these at the moment. And as I say, there's going to be a follow-up just from the sheer weight of people that have got in touch.
Wow. Right, Lee, we wait to see what you produce on that one. Now, moving on, picking an estate agent to sell your home is really important. A good one will make finding your buyer seem like a breeze. The wrong one, and it can cause untold stress, drag the whole process out, and you could end up being forced to reduce your asking price and ultimately sell for less. And there's also an article on your website, Simon, talking about gazundering being on the rise. So you've taken a look at how you pick a good one. What have you found? What tips do you have for us, Simon?
A lot of these will probably feel fairly simple to people, but actually what often happens is people get a couple of estate agents around and then they just go with the one that's given them the highest estimate of what they can put it on the market for. That's not necessarily going to get you the best agent or get your house sold, though, particularly at the moment. If you price too high, you won't get people in through the door. What you really need in order to get the best price for your house is two different people who both want to buy it or more, having a little bit of a bid against each other and driving up the price. What you don't want is nobody coming through the door, nobody making any offers, because the price is too high, and then you have to cut it after it's sat on the market for a while, and then somebody comes in and lowballs you and you're disheartened anyway, and you know. So these are the questions to ask them. What homes have you sold recently? Okay, that's like literally, what have you been doing recently? Looks very nice on Rightmove, your photos look great, but what are you actually selling, and how does that compare to your property? What's the market like at the moment? What you want from them is an honest appraisal of what the market is like near you for homes like yours, and for them to say, look, genuinely, it's a sticky market, people are struggling, mortgage rates are high, they can't pay what they once would, you need to stand out from the crowd, you know, so here's what you need to do. Or they might say, look, the market's great, just stick it up for whatever you want and you can sell it. What are you doing differently in today's market compared to the pandemic boom? Obviously, the pandemic boom was an easy time to sell homes because lots of people were moving, lots of people were trying to buy. When the market's slow, what are you doing then? And I'll come back to this in a minute. Can you sell homes off market? Some people want to stick their home up for sale, but they don't want everybody to know. So they don't want to sit there. They're not absolutely desperate to move right away, or maybe they are desperate to move right away and they don't want everyone to know quite how low they're marketing it. So estate agents will have people on the books and they can, you know, try to sell off market. And this is something that more and more people are interested in. Who will actually be selling my home? Can I meet them? It's all very well the boss coming around and giving you all the patter, but then if you get some fumbling junior trying to flog your property, it might not be so great. Or it might be that actually you're better off with the junior because they're a bit more engaged, they're a bit more enthusiastic, they're a bit more likely to click with the people potentially viewing your home, and the boss is an idiot who'd rather be on the golf course. How do you vet potential buyers? This is quite important because you don't really want time wasters. You do want people through the door, but you don't want time wasters. How will you maximize the value of my home? You want to get the most you possibly can. What are the tips for doing that? Why should I trust your valuation? Don't just look at the number. Say, okay, what have you based this on? Get them to really show you how they've come up with it and what commission will I pay. Now, be careful here because the estate agent will quote you a commission. They might then not quote you it, including VAT. So that means you've got to pay 20% on top of that. That could quickly add up. But also, commission is negotiable. All agents will negotiate on commission. And if they say they won't negotiate on the commission and it seems quite high compared to others, then make them negotiate on the commission. And if they still won't negotiate on the commission, maybe just don't engage them at all. So there you go. And to go back to the what will you do to sell my property differently in today's market? We moved in 2020, just before the pandemic, actually. But we had agreed to sell our flat in London in 2019, in September 2019. And it had been on the market for quite some time. And the market was really, really dead through a lot of 2019. It was that everybody worrying about Brexit year, the Theresa May, the going backwards and forwards, the political turmoil. And everybody thought, God, it's a terrible time to buy a flat in London. You just weren't. The estate agent was saying to us, it's not the price. That's not the issue. Although, you know, I guess if we'd cut an offer off the price, then it would have been fine. We had another estate agent round and he said to us, yeah, I can sell this. He said, your agent just isn't working hard enough. He said, we're always on the phones. We're on the phones all the time. He said, you come into our office sometimes. He's like, we're ringing people up. We're trying to get them round. He said, it's like the Wolf of Wall Street. And then he paused and looked at me and went, but in a good way.
Yeah, I was going to say, in a good way.
Do you know what? Listener, they sold our flat.
There you go. See, when you go in there, you want someone standing with a microphone up in front of Noli. Any tips and gazundering I mentioned there? Explain, if you would. Gazundering on the rise.
I think Simon's gone through all the tips there, but yeah, the gazundering, it's gone from a gazumping market to a gazundering market.
Explain what these words mean.
Well, so gazumping is one of those things where there's a hot market, so lots of people chasing the same property, they might swoop in and make last minute bids to try and, you know, change your mind. So basically you might end up with your property going for more than what you agreed to sell it for. So that can be a real pain in the backside if you were someone that's buying a property, got your heart set on a property, think it's all about to go through, and then someone at the last minute comes in and swoops in and offers a better value, better price. The flip side of that is gazundering, when the market goes a little bit cold, and buyers are holding the power, essentially. The power is shifted to the buyer, and the buyer might get down and at the 11th hour goes, do you know what, I don't want to pay that price anymore, will you accept this instead? And essentially there's data out suggesting that people searching for this has absolutely exploded this year. That last ditch offer, it comes at a time obviously where the market is quite different to what it was at the start of last year, for example. The way to sort of try and avoid it, the number one thing really is just trying to establish trust with the person that you're sort of selling your home to. You also have to look around and what's happening in your local market. You know, in the time that you've accepted an offer, lots of time can pass. It's a process that can take a very, very long time selling a home. And if from the time that you've agreed to completion, the local market, similar properties are falling in price, you can kind of understand why buyers might be in this position in which they want to do this and go for it. You know, as I say, the power is largely in their hands at the moment, unfortunately, depending on whereabouts you live in the country. Now, the ways you can avoid this, one of the things that potentially can work, but you'd have to be pretty lucky, is to choose a chain-free buyer. You know, that's not necessarily realistic. It just depends on who it is that's swooping in. You know, there are a lot of cash buyers, for example, at the moment that will not have a chain. But, you know, sometimes we were just talking about trying to sell a home, beggars can't be choosers type thing. You can't just be, I'm only going to accept a chain-free buyer. I mean, it's a very difficult process and thing to say. You've got to set a date for exchange, move quickly, be realistic about price. I mean, that goes back to when you're picking an estate agent, you know, are they giving you a price that's realistic, or are you overvaluing it? And we've spoken about this. It's not a good thing and a good place to be. And the last thing to do is to get a good estate agent, harking back to what we were just talking about. But it's definitely one of those things that's become more rampant again, and it is a seller's worst nightmare. And it can hold up all sorts of chains. And yeah, we're back in the rise of the gazunderer.
Right, finally, let's have a quick romp around the EV market, Simon. Some big news. The new Tesla Model 3 arrives on our fair shores in January. But it's slightly cheaper, but it's not super cheap. But if it proves to be out of your budget range, what about Citroën's new EC3? That could start around 17 grand. Pros and cons. Right, the Tesla though, Simon, go on, walk us through it. What's going on?
Tesla Model 3, why does this matter? It matters because it is Tesla's cheapest car. Tesla is still the electric car company by which others are benchmarked. The other car companies, the legacy car companies, have come on in leaps and bounds in terms of electric cars in recent years, but Tesla was the real leader on it, and everything gets judged against them. So it is one of the world's best-selling EVs as well. What are you going to get? You're going to get a range of potentially more than 400 miles, only on the more expensive ones, and it should be about £3,000 cheaper. You're going to get a new interior. You're going to get a slight change to the exterior, and you're going to get all the fancy tech that Tesla's come with, including the supercharging, which, you know, Tesla still leads the way in that kind of supercharging network that it's got. The entry level Model 3 rear wheel drive will now start from $39,990. This is a very important to get these cars below the £40,000 benchmark because it has an effect on the tax. The long range variant, the one with the longest range, will be just under £50,000. Expect there's probably to be quite high demand for it, but also expect it not to be quite as in demand as when the Model 3 first came out, because there is a lot more competition now. And there's also more competition from cheaper cars.
Which leads us on to the Citroën's new EC3. It doesn't sound very snappy, I'll be honest. I think they can make more of an effort. I like things like Leaf. That's a nice name.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the whole random letters and number kind of car naming. Sometimes it works. The Mazda MX-5,
I know there's more important things than that. Yeah,
that's great. I mean, but sometimes when it just seems a little bit random, it doesn't work so well. But this is trying to answer the question that car buyers ask of, where are the small, cheap electric cars? The problem with electric cars for many people is, you know, brand new, is they're expensive. You're looking at £30,000 for a small hatchback, and it's way, way more than the equivalent petrol or diesel option. If you can still find a diesel version, and most of these small hatchbacks, you won't be able to find a diesel option. So the EC3, unveiled in Paris this week, is expected to be priced from under £23,000 from launch, which makes it one of the cheapest EVs on sale. But an even cheaper version could follow. So a more affordable EC3 in 2025, with a range of just over 125 miles, could be priced under €19,990, which at current exchange rates works out as £17,000. Will they bring that to the UK market, though, or will that be saved for the French? I mean, they might sell it to other Europeans as well, but obviously bringing it to the UK market means sticking the steering wheel on the other side, which bumps up the cost a bit for Citroën. 125 miles worth of range, that's not a lot. And then when you take that to the real world, you might be looking at under 100 miles. But you've got to bear in mind that most people's journeys are quite short. And so this obsession with range is a bit misguided, because I can't remember what the average is, so I'm not going to make the number up. But most people drive less than 100 miles a week. So actually, you could potentially do a whole week's driving on that. But also, if you've got a home charger, and public charging is much easier nowadays, but it's more expensive. So if you've got a home charger, that's the real win. You probably have to charge it maybe a couple of times a week and just drive around in it. And it's your second car. It's for your local journeys. Or if you're eco-minded, maybe you get the train for the longer journeys. If you're not eco-minded and you're a family, you might have a bigger family car that you do the longer journeys in. And I think maybe that's actually a bit of a win, this kind of thing, for electric car adoption. Because electric cars, really, it's not just about the impact on the planet, it's about the impact on air quality as well. And if lots of people's driving is just locally, the bulk of their driving is locally, then if they're driving a smaller electric car around locally, charging up, there's no tailpipe emissions, it's theoretically better for the planet in terms of the CO2, because it's not emitting any CO2, the car itself. There will be CO2 emitted by the generating of the energy, unless you have a renewable energy tariff, and then hopefully you're buying green energy anyway. Obviously, making the car is not great for the environment. But you drive around locally in this car, and then when you do your longer journeys, for example, you go off somewhere 200 miles away across the UK or whatever, you use the bigger family car. And actually, do you know what I'm gonna say? I think that it's not a bad idea for that potentially to be a diesel, because they are a lot more fuel efficient than petrol cars. I had a Mercedes C-Class Estate test car the other week to do a review on, which will be coming soon on This Is Money, and it was a diesel. And I went to Abergavenny for my cousin's wedding, and I averaged 57 miles to the gallon. Estate car, family estate car, four adults in it, 57 miles to the gallon there, 57 miles to the gallon back. I went to Abergavenny and back on less than half a tank of diesel.
Wow, that's decent.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is. And then when you start translating this into the fact that a lot of people aren't driving estate cars nowadays, they're driving massive, great, heavy SUVs. Those are much better suited to diesel power than petrol power. So yeah, run a little Citroen electric run around locally. And then if you're going to do a long journey, use the bigger car. But I don't think we're going to see a revival in diesel cars anytime soon.
No, probably not. But talking of long journeys, talking of France, range anxiety. Look, I'll be honest, I am not someone that typically uses their car for short journeys. I drive it to Derby County from Surrey and to see my relatives, which who don't live that close. And I don't like the idea of if I need to go in an emergency quite far that I'm going to have to wait ages to charge it. But be that as it may, I'm not going to France in an EV. However, so that we don't have to, you've got a diary of a chap who's decided to do it. Paul Barker, managing editor at car sales website Car Wow, also motoring journalists of many decades, gave it a go. What did he find out? I assume he didn't give it a go in the Citroen EC3, which can only really do about 100 miles. That would be just too annoying, wouldn't it?
It would, wouldn't it? Yeah, I think you'd take you a long time to do that. You'd need the sort of amount of time to do a journey that is reserved for the retired or the very, very wealthy or students, maybe.
Yeah.
But yeah, not the kind of amount of time for a journey that you have on a family holiday. Okay, so one thing to bear in mind here is that he took a very expensive electric car on holiday. He took a 123,000 BMW iX for a 2-week family break. So it's not really roughing it. Okay.
No.
It's a big old BMW SUV.
That's not a student trip, Simon.
No, but it's this is a proper family road trip test. Okay. And we love these. We do these all the time on Cars and This Is Money. This is how we love to test a car. Get someone to lend us a car, and then we go drive it a really, really long way with the family and all the stuff in it. And that's how you find out whether a car's any good. I'm looking at a picture of this BMW right now that he used at a charging station. It's got a roof box on. It's got bikes on the back. It's properly fully laden down. 572-mile run to the west coast of France. Now, obviously, the main concern was range. How often are you going to have to stop? But then it's also, when you do stop, is the charger going to be working? Didn't go amazingly well at the... when they first started to try to do this, because they discovered that one of the chargers was flashing up and out of order on the screen. But he found that it was okay. You just have to do quite a lot more planning and quite a lot more stopping and quite a lot more buying things like crepes for the family to amuse them while you stop for 30 minutes and it charges. And he did say that, you know, despite keeping the speed down to a cruise controlled 65 mile an hour on the auto route, and if you've driven long distances on empty French auto routes, you'll know that 65 miles an hour is quite a low speed. They were managing a comfortable 120 miles or so before the battery started dropping down to the level where it needed a charge. So this is the concern for people. But as I said, it is fully loaded. And I won't go into the full details of the diary here, but if you want to go to thisismoney.co.uk/electric cars, you'll find our electric cars section. You'll find loads of really good guides, articles, pieces of information about electric cars, and you'll find the full article of this. And I recommend giving it a read. What I would say is that I have considered doing this. I have considered getting an electric car review car and doing one of our long family holiday journeys. So basically, we went away in summer. We went down to the southwest coast of France, the bottom. By the time we've been there and come back, we've racked up 2,000 miles. Last Easter, we drove to the Alps to go snowboarding, skiing. We racked up pretty much 2,000 miles. So I've thought about doing a 2,000 mile journey and testing it out. Not so worried about the range stuff. I think it's okay. You just have to plan ahead. You just have to plan to stop. But when I've worked it out in my head of how many times are we going to have to stop compared to how many times we'd have to stop in a petrol or diesel car, and how long are we going to have to stop for each time, And how much of an extra hassle is this going to be? I must admit that I haven't done it yet.
But if you do, Simon, make sure you get one well over 100 grand. Get a real top class one, Simon. One that, you know, every person could do, because that's what we're here for. We're journalists of the people, you know?
I would love to see the look on my wife and kids' face when I told them I was stuffing them into that Citroen to drive them 1,000 miles.
I love it. That would be a lot of stops. Right, that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. And you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in the debate and read the comments. And actually, we spoke about this a few weeks back and said to people to email us about if they have an electric car, their experience of owning an electric car. We still want more of those. So if you've got an electric car, if you listen to what I just said and you thought that you disagreed with me because you've got an electric car and none of these things are a problem, or actually you thought, you know what, this is absolutely true. I've got an electric car. I've done that long journey. It was a right pain. Or I've done that long journey and it was totally fine. Email us, editor@thisismoney.co.uk, stick electric cars in the subject line. We're going to pull together the best of those for an article. You don't have to be named in the article, and we'll talk about it on the podcast soon. So yeah, we want to hear more of that.
Indeed. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.